This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Borman, directed the new film The General, based on the life of the notorious Irish thief and gangster Martin Cahill. Cahill stole about $60 million in a series of ingenious robberies he masterminded in the 1980s. He worked his way up from petty crimes to stealing Vermeer paintings and precious jewels. Despite being the most wanted man in Ireland, Cahill managed to elude the police while thumbing his nose at them. Later we'll meet John Voight, who plays the police inspector determined to capture Cahill. John Borman has directed many other films, including Deliverance, Point Blank, Hope and Glory, Excalibur, The Emerald Forest, and Beyond Rangoon. The General was shot on location in Dublin. Here's a scene in which Cahill, played by Brendan Gleeson, goes to see Inspector Kenny, played by John Voight. Cahill knows that while they're talking, his men are robbing a nearby bank. The inspector is skeptical of the motivation behind Cahill's visit.
Come to confess a few crimes?
Just want to welcome you back to the neighborhood, Inspector. It's nice and peaceful now, isn't it?
You know why they sent me here, don't you?
Not because of me, I hope.
Yes, because of you. Because they think I know your wiles and your ways. And I do. It can only end one way, Martin. You keep on like this.
No.
I'm a poor fellow. Haven't much. That's up to here. But I can sleep at night.
Yeah, I've seen you outside me flat there a few times.
Oh.
No, you should drop in the next time you're passing. You know? Have an old jar.
Bank robbery! Across the street! Come on! The Celtic Bank! Come on, hurry up!
Disgrace for the profits these banks are making.
Bank across the street, the Celtic Bank!
You made a right bollocks out of me, didn't you, Martin? Congratulations.
One of Martin Cahill's burglary victims in the 1980s was director John Borman. Borman told me what happened.
He had rather good taste. I mean, he took some very fine silver and also a little Georgian table. Then I had a gold record which had been given me for the music of Deliverance, dueling banjos. And he took that, obviously thinking that it was solid gold. He obviously didn't know much about record companies. And so, as you may have noticed, I put that scene into the movie.
Yes, and in the movie he breaks the gold record in half and says, see, it's not really gold.
Yeah, he's disgusted with it. It confirms his view of the world that everything is fake and that half the population are criminals.
Now, I think one of the eeriest scenes in the movie is early on during that cat burglar phase when he's breaking into people's homes. And it's as if he's a ghost walking through people's homes while they're there, while they're awake, some of them while they're sleeping, and no one notices that he's there.
Yes, he had this great reputation as a creeper. And he had an enormous will. He was able to, if he was found himself in a house and someone was stirred, he could stand in the shadows or in a closet for hours on end without moving a muscle. And he, you know, even in later years when he became, the general organizing these great heists, he still, as a hobby, would go out at night and break into people's houses, usually just to raid the refrigerator. Because I think this was the beginning, you know, hark back to the origins of his career as a thief, that he used to rob food, break into houses and shops, stores, and rob food for his fatherless family. And that was a pattern he never broke.
Why did you want to make a movie about Cahill?
Well, because, first of all, he was such a fascinating character. I mean, and the contrast in his personality were extraordinary. I mean, he was called the General because of his meticulous military planning that he did with these robberies. And seldom do you find, with that sort of mind, a kind of clown to go with it. And he had this wit and humor and this sardonic humor, and he was brutal and tender, and he was a loving father and a husband to two sisters. I mean, he lived with two sisters, had four children with each of them, and they lived apparently harmoniously. It was so intriguing. But beyond that, he represented something more for me because, you know, I've always felt, I've been living in Ireland for 30 years. I'm not Irish, really. But it's a spiritual home to me. And I've always felt that beneath the Christianity, that Ireland is still fundamentally a kind of pagan place. Because the church is a kind of, has been really kind of a colonial power, which has been repressive, really. And, of course, the British occupation as well. So and from time to time, this kind of archetype erupts from the racial unconscious, this kind of rebels appear, and they are anarchists. They're opposed to all of society, and they are eventually, you know, in order to prove their credentials as a rebel, they manage to get themselves killed. I mean, Michael Collins, for instance, was a very similar figure. The planning, the wit, the humour, the ruthlessness. So this figure is very important, and the figure of the rebel in Irish life is very important. And so for me, this Cahill's life somehow illuminates the society that he comes from because of the way that he opposes it.
Why were there frictions between Cahill and the IRA?
You see, he was opposed to all authority, really. And so far as he was concerned, the IRA was another institution with another set of rules. And he kind of just despised them. It was complicated, really, because they were always trying to get a share of his loot. They were always trying to control, I mean, their methods were to control the population, particularly at the lowest level, you know, which is where he came from, by protection and by controlling, like, you know, punishing drug dealers with kneecapping and that sort of thing. And he resented their intrusion into what he thought was his territory. And now there were, he had, you know, there were a couple of occasions where actually they kidnapped a couple of his men and he paid ransoms to the IRA. So, you know, he was pragmatic about it, but they were incensed when he began to have dealings with the Protestant terrorist groups because when he was trying to fence these paintings. And that, I think, was what really got up their nose. And, of course, they eventually shot him. On the last day of the ceasefire in 1994, so it was obviously very important to them to kill him while they still, as it were, had a license to kill. And I had obviously to be quite careful when I was making this film because, you know, for legal reasons and libel. And I imply in the film that there was collusion between the police and the IRA in the killing of Cahill because he was under 24-hour surveillance with police surrounding his house. There were 90 men on this task. And on this particular morning, you know, there was no police there at all. And he and his wife assumed that they'd given up finally. And so he went out to his car and suddenly the assassin ran at him and shot him in his car. So I made a lot of investigation and research into what was behind it. And I became convinced that there was collusion.
My guest is director John Borman. His new film is called The General. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Borman. His films include Deliverance, Point Blank, and Hope and Glory. His new film is called The General. You've been living in Ireland for about 30 years. You grew up in England, lived, I think, in America on the West Coast for a while. Why did you move to Ireland?
Well, when I went to America from England, it was immensely liberating. And it made me realize just how sort of narrow and negative so much of English life was, and how class conscious it was. And there in America, everything was so positive and possible. And I enjoyed that exhilaration. And then I somehow reached a point where I just didn't want to bring my children up in Los Angeles. And so I fled. I mean, I've always been in love with America, but I never really wanted to get married, if you know what I mean. And so I was shooting a film in Ireland, shooting part of a film in Ireland when I was, and I fell in love with this landscape of the Wicklow Mountains and the people and the spirit of the place. And so it became a refuge for me, and bought a house there, and not really intending to stay. And I've been living in that same house for the last 30 years.
Before you started making movies, you worked in television in England, and among your assignments there was doing documentaries. I was reading that one of the documentaries you did had quite an effect on the young woman who was the subject of the film. What I read was that she had been rebelling against family and religion, and she was so uncomfortable with the notoriety that was caused by the documentary that she kind of took hiding at your house with your family. What was the story behind that?
Well, I started making a number of documentaries. This was in the early 60s, about people. And the society was rapidly changing. I mean, it was the Beatles era. And I think what had occurred, which hadn't really been recognized, was that just, you know, after 1947, when the Education Act set up these secondary modern schools, that really radically changed the way in which people were educated. And you know, music and drama were introduced into the schools, and suddenly you got people who were growing up with a completely different kind of sensibility, and that was the kind of thing that produced the Beatles and all that, and the swinging London and all of that, and this was the early stages of it, and I went around and found people who were really changing in different ways, and made films about them. Now, and the films were immensely successful and caused tremendous stir because, in a sense, people were suddenly confronted with these people who they didn't realize existed. It was like a new breed of people was emerging. And so there was great kind of excitement about it. And this was a girl who was at school, a 16-year-old girl, who... She was adopted by a Salvation Army family, and she was very radical in her ideas, and her coming from a very severe and religious background, and it did the notoriety was had a devastating effect on her, and in fact she came to live with me and my wife because she was she needed refuge, and that's when I started. That's when I felt that there was something wrong about making documentaries of that nature, because the people involved were made very vulnerable by it, and so that I started to dramatize. I started to make fiction.
Do you still feel that way about documentaries?
Well, so that kind of documentary that is, yes, I do. I think it's dangerous, and it does endanger people. But, I mean, I just made a documentary, as a matter of fact, myself, but it was a much different kind of one about Lee Marvin.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'd like to ask you about Lee Marvin, but first I just want to get back to this theme of people changing in that kind of... early Beatles era. Your first feature film was the 1965 film Catch Us If You Can, which is known in America as Having a Wild Weekend, which starred the Dave Clark Five, which is one of the big British invasion groups here in America. Was that seen as being connected to the documentary subjects that you were doing?
Very much so. And in fact, the film is full of characters who are drawn from my documentaries. And Peter Nichols and I, who wrote the script, we wove together various aspects of the films I'd made for the BBC. And so it was very much about that era. And it was a very pessimistic film, really, and about the way in which this youth explosion and rebellion was fundamentally going to be thwarted by society, which turned out to be the case.
Well, let's get to Lee Marvin. You made the 1967 film Point Blank that he starred in. How did you first meet him? And I guess more importantly, what is his importance to your career and your work and your thoughts on filmmaking?
Oh, tremendously. I just made this documentary about him, and which was really, in a sense, a study of our relationship and on these two films that we made together. And when I first met him,
the second was Hell in the Pacific.
Yes. When I first met him, he was shooting The Dirty Dozen in London, and a producer gave me a script and gave it to him too. And we met. And Lee said, "What do you think of this script?" I said, "It's absolutely terrible." And he said, "Well, I agree. So what are we talking about?" I said, "Well, the character's fascinating." And it was from a book by Donald Westlake. And so we met a number of times and talked. And I began to get a picture of Marvin. I'd always been kind of fascinated by him, by this his kind of violence. And when I talked, I began to understand how important his war experience had been, where he'd been ambushed and wounded in Saipan. He'd been involved in a number of battles that had killed a lot of Japanese, and that he had been brutalized. He was a young boy, 17, and he'd been brutalized by this war experience, and somehow he was in his violent roles that he played, he was somehow replaying these experiences or trying to exorcise the experience. And so Point Blank became, in a way, a story of Lee Marvin. It was a film about him, and that's what gave it its great resonance, I think.
Lee Marvin strikes me as a very American kind of actor, in the sense that the stereotype of the British actor is of the actor who's classically trained, and the stereotype of the American actor is the actor who isn't necessarily trained but has great intuition about acting. And although I don't know much about Lee Marvin's background, I would imagine he fits into that American stereotype of being the intuitive actor.
Oddly enough, that's not the case. I mean, he's full of contradictions, really, because he played a lot of classical theater in New York in his beginning of his career.
No, that surprises me, because I just always think of him as the tough guy.
That's right. Well, he was much more than that. But what he did have was a tremendous controlling intelligence, and at the same time, he had these darker instincts, which were always, the two things were always in conflict and very often in balance. When he was working at his best.
Now, in the movie Hell in the Pacific, you directed Lee Marvin and Toshiro Mifune, and Mifune is most famous for the films that he made with the Japanese director Kurosawa. Mifune, in his own way, is a very broad actor, almost hammy by American standards, and in that sense, just the opposite of Lee Marvin. And I'm wondering what it was like to work with both of them in the same film.
It was a nightmare. Kurosawa said, you can't direct Mifune, you can only point him in a direction. And he was like a force of nature. And with all that kind of explosive, over-the-top kind of emotion. And so my role was like a fireman. I was always squirting a hose at him to try and keep him down, you know, and struggling with him to get him to do what I wanted, and it took so much time to get the performance I wanted. And by the time I'd get Mifune into shape, Lee Marvin was down the other end of a beach, drunk, And it was a total nightmare.
Did they get along with each other?
They loved each other. They loved each other. They were absolutely, you know, and this was, it was, a, this was, a, I mentioned that Point Blank was a kind of journey for Lee, but Helen Pacific was even more so because we were going back to revisit this, the Second World War, and here he was making a film with the Japanese that he'd fought against. So it was there were all sorts of levels going on there, and it was pretty hard to handle.
Film director John Boorman. His new movie is called The General. Boorman will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with director John Boorman. His new movie, The General, is based on the story of the notorious Irish gangster Martin Cahill. Boorman's other films include Deliverance, Point Blank, Excalibur, The Emerald Forest, and Hope and Glory. You directed the film Deliverance, based on the James Dickey novel. And of course, you know, the most famous scene in that movie is the scene in which the Ned Beatty character is raped by one of the people who they meet on this canoe trip that they're taking. I recently talked to James Dickey's son, Christopher Dickey, who wrote a memoir about his father. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it or not. But, you know, he writes in that memoir that he felt kind of traumatized during the making of the film because he was the stand-in for Ned Beatty during the shooting of the rape scene. So while they were setting up the lighting and stuff like that, it was Christopher Dickey who was playing the part. Did you realize that he was upset by being the stand-in in that role?
I think he'd romanticizing a little bit. He was you know, working as a stand-in, and a stand-in just simply stands there while you put the lights on him. It doesn't he doesn't rehearse, or he doesn't have to play the scene in any way. He's just standing around there while to give the actor, so the actor doesn't have to stand there while the lighting's going on. So I read the excerpt in the New Yorker, and I think he writes very, very well. And of course, he and most of what he said there was, you know, it's quite accurate. His father, I mean, he did have a very difficult relationship with his father. And Dickie, you know, who I admired enormously, and he was also a very, very difficult man, and he drank a lot. And when we were rehearsing, before we started shooting the picture and the rehearsal period, the four actors got very upset about him because he was very overbearing, and he would only address them as by the characters they were playing. And Jim Dickey, you know, when I first met him, he said to me, "I'm going to tell you something I never told a living soul." He said, "Everything in that book happened to me." And I was absolutely shocked, you know, by this. But then of course, I began to realize he was telling everybody this story, and it was patently, you know. And I said to Jim at one point, I said, "You know, I'm much more impressed that you could have imagined and invented all this than if it happened to you." You know, he lived on the edges of reality in some respects. And finally, I had to tell him to leave because his presence was becoming really a problem. And eventually, so he said, "All right, I'll go, but I want to say goodbye to the boys." So we went down to where we were rehearsing, and he came in and he drew himself up and he said, "It appears that my presence would be most efficacious by its absence." And he turned on his heel and he left. And Bert Reynolds said to me, "Does that mean he's going or he's staying?"
So did things go smoother after he left?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And then he came back to play the sheriff, which he did very well.
Right, right. You've written that you had to get completion insurance for the new movie, The General, which required your getting a physical. Why don't you just briefly explain what completion insurance is?
Well, you know, you get insurance company insures the film against to complete it. In other words, if for any reason, say, one of the lead actors dies or is incapacitated and can't complete the film, you know, you either recast it and start again, or you abandon the film, in which case the insurance company has to pay up. And it's a big deal. So they want to make sure that you're not going to die when you're in the course of making the film. So I had to do one of these medicals, and I did this treadmill test, and they said, oh, you've got a heart disease. And
So what did you do when they told you that? Did you decide, well, the heck with this movie?
And they said, you've got to go in the hospital and have an angiogram right away, and, you know, you could drop dead at any moment. And so I said, well, I can't possibly do that. I'm making a film, you know, which is much more important than life and death. And so I went through and I completed the film, being careful not to run up the stairs and things like that. Cut down on my intake of animal fats. And then at the end of the film, I went, you know, and had an angiogram. And it was completely a false alarm, you know, and I had this angiogram, and the specialist said, well, you know, he said, not only do you not have heart disease, he said, you'll never have heart disease. He said, you know, your arteries and your valves and everything are in perfect condition. You'll die of something else, he said. Of course, he said, probably something much more painful. A heart attack, you know, it's not a bad way of going.
Oh, gosh. Do you think that what you thought might be a death sentence hanging over your head affected how you made The General?
I hope not. Curiously, it was, you know, it's just a little nagging doubt I had in my mind all the time, because generally speaking, it was a real pleasure making the film. There was also the fear that the criminals might take action against me in some way, or the IRA. So my life was kind of, I felt my life was on the line, and in a sense, that's not a bad way to feel, because isn't that, after all, the reality?
Do you feel that way now?
Well, yes. I mean, that in a sense, one's life is on the line. You know, I mean, I'm 65 years old, so death is rapidly approaching, and I have to face it with the same kind of endurance and courage that I've used in making films.
John Boorman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
John Boorman, his new movie is called The General. This is Fresh Air.